Esther 1, verses 19 through 22. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. When the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor, both to great and small. And the saying pleased the king and the princes. And the king did according to the word of Memucan. For he sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province, according to the writing thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people. Now it's interesting that this king's domestic dispute has been turned into a matter of state. A single act of insubordination by a wife has become elevated to the point of being a national crisis. Whatever we think of the matter at hand, this story, I think, very clearly emphasizes the importance that households play in the rise and fall of nations. Additionally, it demonstrates why the private conduct of public figures, especially those who are to bear the rule over others, why that should be a concern for the people who are under their government. Why should we have canons of public ethics? Why should we require certain standards of morality in those who are public figures, especially those who rule, either in church or in state? It's not simply the example. Although, as I've said before, the example is a very big problem. But there's also this other matter. Besides the bad example, at a broader level, perhaps at a more systemic level, there is the instability that this kind of behavior produces in a nation. Furthermore, I think it's worthy of considering the case as it is before us, as it stands here. It's almost impossible to appreciate without a little reflection. But in essence, what we have is this. The anger of the king has been moved by the vanity of his wife. And in fact, this has actually moved his passions more than the wine that they had consumed throughout all of this feasting. However, we should reflect for a moment this. It should be clear to us that the source of all that follows is not really so much his anger, although he's angry at her vanity, but lest we forget, it was his vanity that started this ball rolling. Had he not consumed his time and his passions with making a display of the vast wealth which he possessed, it's very unlikely that he would have made that next step. Because you see, that display of his wealth leads him directly to summoning his wife for all to behold. So if it were not for his vanity, this entire crisis would have and could have been averted. Now also, keep in mind the great care that the king uses in the matter of Vashti. This is, again, a remarkable thing in the book of Esther. We're told that it was his custom to consult with those who were experts in the law, those who knew the times and the seasons, those who understood the statutes of the realm. He was a king who enjoyed counsel. And in this case, he does indeed avail himself of the counsel which is available. And yet later in the book of Esther, when he decrees to kill Haman, he's not going to seek any such counsel. In fact, he's not even going to conduct any kind of trial. As we'll see, Lord willing, it's quite likely that had he simply submitted the case of Haman to the judgment of others, that Haman would have been acquitted. Because we know that his intention when he fell upon the bed of Esther was not to ravish her, but to beg mercy. And so had passion been removed just a bit from that scene, Haman's life might have been spared. But you see, the seeds of Haman's destruction are sown in this event. And all of this reminds us that there's a greater governor. There's one greater than the king of Persia. There's one greater than all of these counselors. One who rules over the nations. One whose counsel cannot be overturned. One who moves all of the affairs of the nations to his own end and purpose. Again, as the rabbis have noted, the great miracle of Esther appears in hundreds, maybe thousands of seemingly coincidental incidents that unfold and lay the fabric of the plot that will bring about the deliverance of the people of God. Now, Mamukin, who was, as we know from history, a younger brother of Ahasuerus, or Xerxes, Mamukin has parlayed this initial anger of the king at Vashti's refusal to come to him into a platform that, in the end, results in the equivalent of a domestic coup. Clearly, he aims to blunt any feminine influence in the court. And furthermore, he drives his appeal to the king along very plausible lines. He's suggested with very great probability that Vashti's example is going to infect many, perhaps even every, house in all of the provinces and dominions of the king. The concern that he expresses was that throughout the empire, many, many women are going to exercise some kind of insubordination against the rule of their husbands. Now, with that kind of advice, what Mamukin is actually doing is he's forcing the hand of the king. Because if the king were at all inclined to mercy, and Mamukin's advice and counsel proved correct, the king would look weak and vacillating. He would look perhaps foolish in the eyes of the people. And yet, as we're going to see, by accepting Mamukin's advice, the king looks equally foolish, I think. So the advice of Mamukin forces the hand of the king to act in a manner far more severe than I think we have reason to suspect he was inclined to act prior to Mamukin's counsel. The result of this is it's going to bring about a series of actions that will trouble the king. It'll be a matter of great regret on the part of the king when he reflects upon it later. And it's going to influence, I believe, his actions later in the story of Esther. Mamukin, who knows the laws of the empire then, now begins to set forth the punishment which women who disobey their husbands deserve. Thus, we see that a relatively simple, uncomplicated, seeming domestic quarrel has turned into a consultation that prepares the way for the deliverance of the people of God. And it does so by turning the world of the heathen upside down. It's sparked by the action of a king swollen with pride and walking in vanity. And this spark becomes a great flame that's going to burn down his empire simply through the response that he's going to make to the actions of the queen. Now, the reason for this, of course, is, as we know from Daniel's prophecy and as we come to see throughout the story of Esther, the Persian Empire must give way. The prophecies of God must stand firm. The purposes of God must be accomplished, and the people of God must not be allowed to remain unspoken for, trodden down, and abused by the heathen forever. So verse 19. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered. That Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. If it please the king. With these words, Mamukin counsels the king to set aside law and statute and to govern according to his own whim. Now, this helps us then to understand what happens later in the case of Haman, as I said a few minutes ago. You see, the outcome of the Vashti affair begins with advice to move Persian government into an absolute dictatorship, with Ahasuerus exercising rule without the benefit of any of the previous constraints or what we would call checks and balances that he had prior to this incident. The encouragement here, the counsel of Mamukin, is that everything should be reduced to the mere pleasure of the sovereign. And hereafter we shall see again and again this kind of deference to the mere word of the king without any concern for prior counsel. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him. Mamukin, remember, has given a detailed exposition of how he believes the queen's offense could destabilize the entire empire. How it could, in fact, undermine the rule of the king. How it could bring confusion to the people. Vashti's rebellion, according to Mamukin's narrative, that could be the tip of this feminist spear into the rule and the role of men. So now he spells out his plan for the queen. But since Mamukin is not really in any power to act directly in this matter, nor can he himself speak to the people directly with respect to this matter, he has to rely upon his persuasion to get the king to act in accordance with his counsel. He has to persuade the king to do what he wants him to do. So he says there has to be a royal edict, a royal commandment, which will carry this counsel, because Mamukin's word isn't going to carry any weight at all. If it doesn't come from the king, it's not going to prevail. If it doesn't come from the king, it will not be efficacious. So it's apparent that Mamukin's counsel cannot be accomplished without the consent of the king. And yet, through this story, we see the true God prevail over his and our enemies without their consent and despite their initial or perhaps prolonged intentions. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes. And so, after telling the king that it's going to have to go forth in his name, that apart from the king issuing this edict, it will not have any effect, Mamukin suggests that, along with that, that this commandment, this decree of the king, that it should be written among the laws which had been codified in the empire of both Media and Persia. What he's doing here is this. He's counseling the king to place his desires at that moment, on par with the written laws. In this way, he's saying this royal edict is going to be enshrined in the written law. And that will actually give an extra shine to this decree, because it's going to partake of the glory of the royal law. Law which had actually transcended the kingdom of the Medes and now found place in the statutes of the Persians. The Persians were very careful not to disturb the laws and customs of conquered peoples, particularly if they found them either useful for their own purposes or if they were accounted popular and in some way non-threatening to the regime change. Let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes that it be not altered. Now here is exactly why Mamukin is interested in it being written down. This is the reason why Mamukin seeks to have the king's decree recorded among the laws of the Persians and the Medes. You see, once it's been transcribed and recorded, it's going to take on the character of all the other laws that are enshrined in the law, that codified law of the Persians and the Medes. It's going to become unalterable. Not going to be able to be altered. In other words, what he's doing is he's setting up a line of defense to make sure that there's no possibility, if his counsel's taken, there'll be no possibility of any retaliation from the queen or anyone who might be allied to the queen. Once subjected to the prescribed punishment, doing what Mamukin suggests, she would be forever barred from seeking redress or pursuing revenge. And so she and her potential allies are going to be blocked from taking any future action against Mamukin or his supporters. The king's word, by writing it among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, the king's word would become unalterable law, and the queen's removal would be beyond appeal, and for her and her supporters, beyond all hope of turning that back. Now, the idea of unalterable laws among the Medes and the Persians is one that appears elsewhere in Scripture. Daniel 6:8, we read, "Now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing, that it be not changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which altereth not." Now, it's undoubtedly a good thing when men do not make and rescind laws with every wind of change in government. Nonetheless, I think there is implied here a certain folly in the endeavors of men trying to legislate with no possibility of revisiting or amending a matter of law. In fact, I think that this feature of the laws of the Medes and Persians, now in Esther's day, the Persians and Medes, because the Persians are now ascendant, this feature of the law demonstrates that they're not powers ordained of God, but rather they are powers that are in rebellion from God. These are powers which seek to set their laws against and beside the laws of God, which alone are unalterable. They're seeking to instill in their laws that same kind of spark of divinity that pertains only to the law of God and makes it unalterable. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus. That's the decree which Memucan is seeking against Vashti. Now, from this, and from the unalterable outcome, many of the rabbis have concluded that Vashti was not only removed from office, but subsequently was executed. And while it's not expressly mentioned in our text that she was executed, we do know that it was not an uncommon thing for monarchs to dispose of unwanted spouses in such a manner. In fact, as recently as cases in Western history, like Henry VIII, we have examples of queens being executed to make room for other queens. Additionally, I think that this explanation has some merit in explaining why Ahasuerus' reaction later to Haman is so severe a judgment. Because there's something about the outcome of this judgment that really left a bitter memory. And finally, I would suggest that the very next clause speaks of a transference in terms of a transference of royal estate in terms of a bequeathing or an inheriting that may well presume something akin to her being executed. You don't want to leave someone who's going to be that dissatisfied around to complain, make potential allies, make additional claims to the throne through children, legitimate or illegitimate. You just don't want all of that. It just brings more and more confusion. And so that's why normally people in this position would have been executed by the heathen monarchs. If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him. Let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered. That Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. Now Memucan is adding this to his counsel. He's not only suggesting that the queen be taken away, taken out of the picture, but he is pressing something more than this. He's pressing that everything that pertains to the Queen, what is translated in the King James as the royal estate, but it is a very comprehensive term. It could indicate all that pertains to her royalty as queen, that should be taken from her and given to another. And that this royal estate was to be given to one who is better than she, that is, to Esther. Now, here I think the Midrash makes a very interesting connection. You see, when Saul, the king of Israel, sinned, he was confronted by Samuel the prophet. And in 1 Samuel 15, verse 28, we read, Samuel said unto him, "The Lord hath rent the kingdom of Israel from thee this day, and hath given it to a neighbor of thine that is better than thou." Now the Jews note from this that while Saul deserved to lose the kingdom, he really didn't deserve to be told that his successor would be better than him. So the idea here is this, that God weighs every action and he recompenses to every man as he deserves. The judgment isn't too heavy and it's not too light. And so, because Samuel makes this judgment a little too heavy, this praise of one better than thou is placed upon a descendant of Saul, Esther, when she is set to ascend to the throne. Esther, who would come into his place. In other words, nothing is unaccounted for in the divine calculation. The consequences of both the good and the evil that men do is rewarded or punished in just proportion. And in this decree, Memucan, then, like Caiaphas the high priest during the time of Christ, speaks something unwittingly but true to the decree of God. Verse 20. "And when the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all the empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor, both to great and small." And when the king's decree shall, which he shall make. Remember, Memucan has no authority in himself to move this action or this advice forward. But having presented the counsel and advice, Memucan wants to move the issue forward with the king. So what he does is he moves beyond the presentation and he assumes that his advice is going to be enacted into law. He assumes that the king is going to take that advice. Now, to many people, this might seem to be a bit presumptuous. However, this tactic is actually one very commonly used in those people who are most persuasive. Memucan is asking the king to look beyond taking his counsel and presenting to him a vision of the world in which the king has already made this decree. He's already made it very easy for the king then to imagine this is in place. He tells Ahasuerus what he wants him to do, and then he tells him in effect that he's going to do that very thing. And this, believe it or not, this tactic has a tendency to overcome opposition and resistance, and to make the acceptance of Memucan's desire not only seem plausible, but at that moment appear very sensible. "When the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his empire." When the king's decree has been made, Memucan continues, "it should be published." The king should be careful to publicize the nature and degree of that punishment which is to be enacted upon Vashti. Moreover, Memucan wishes that the king will ensure that the details are made known throughout the whole of the kingdom or the whole of the empire. Now that's very much in keeping with his fear or his argument, depending on how you look at it, that the king's evil example, or excuse me, the queen's evil example, might find reception throughout the empire. So what he's doing is he's moving the argument beyond the present into the future. Into a future wherein the king's decree is not only made, but published now throughout all the empire. When the king's decree shall, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great. And these words do not describe the decree. They describe the empire. It's vast. It's great in size. It encompasses a lot. Hence, the need to see that the decree is taken to its various provinces. Remember, 127 of them. The idea then is something like this. Wherever the actions of the queen might have been repeated, wherever anyone may have heard tell of this refusal on the part of the queen, the overriding response of the king would supplant that news. What he's doing is very much akin to what is done nowadays when one news cycle displaces another. When you have one bit of news that sort of catches the public attention and it remains there in a state of what I'm sure for the people involved seems like perpetual discussion and examination until some other news of more moment, greater consequence comes forward. And then the news cycle flips. That's what he's saying needs to happen. This is a great empire. And so in order to flip this news cycle, you have to get this out everywhere. Memucan is reminding the king of the greatness of the empire as a means, I think, here of impressing upon him the seriousness of the matter. This is another call to action on his part. This is another attempt on the part of Memucan to get the king to follow through with his advice. From Mamukin's point of view, according to his counsel, for the punishment to be really successful, news of it has to reach everywhere over which the king reigns. Because if it doesn't, the risk remains that some portion of the kingdom will in fact turn into a nest of rebellion. When the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor. The result, remember, this is still Memucan, it hasn't even been published yet, but he's imaging this for the king. The result, as he's imaging it for the king, is that the wives under his dominions shall all be kept in check. What he's presenting is a vision which will where he's saying this will restrain any of the latent feminist inclinations that these women have to disobey or dishonor their husbands. And so with these words, Memucan is tying together everything as he's stressing the need for the king to act decisively on behalf of all of the men in his realm. It's not going to do then to let this matter drop. It's not going to do to add any tincture of mercy in this judgment. Because the more Mamukin is talking, the greater that rebellion seems to be. It's a crisis now, as Mamukin is telling us, a crisis which consumes the kingdom. And implied in this is this: if the king does not issue the decree, much after Mamukin's proposal, if he tries to moderate or modify it too much, he will have been warned, and he will be surrendering domestic tranquility for all of the men that live under his rule. Now, why is that such a heavy concern for this king? Well, if we recall the impending war plans, it can't be a good place for the king to begin having all of these houses out of order if he's intending to take a lot of these men into war against Greece. Now, it's best when wives obey their husbands out of a genuine love and respect. And it's presumed among the people of God, the righteous, that this is how it's going to be. However, it appears that Ahasuerus and Mamukin, like all of the wicked, what they want is honor and power without seeking any mutual respect. And so they're going to gain this honor by decree, because that's the only way the wicked can ever get others to do their will. They have to force them to do it. Whereas the righteous often have no need to force anyone. You know, the righteous go forth bold as a lion, and the wicked flee when no man pursues. The wicked have to put down rebellion by force. But the righteous don't have that same kind of need, because the righteous don't have the same kinds of problems that arise in societies characterized by this kind of evil. And the righteous, even when they have no power, the fact is that people very often will yield them honor. And that's going to become clear later on when we look at the case of Mordecai. There's a man with no power in the Persian kingdom, and yet he's going to exert great power. He has no authority, I should say, but he will exert great power because he has a different kind of authority, not that Persian authority, but one, actually a higher authority of God. People are going to yield him honor. He doesn't need to force them to do anything. They're going to do it because he is someone that God has appointed to lead his people. When the king's decree, which he shall make, shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives shall give to their husbands honor, both the great and small. Now, this clause, once more, suggests that Mamukin's concerns were, as mentioned previously, his concerns are not simply for the working classes, but he's also concerned about the nobility. And again, this suggests that Mamukin, perhaps those who sat with him in this council, were already feeling some of the domestic fallout in their own households from the actions of the queen. Now, this, of course, would be the most likely group that would feel these kinds of effects anyway. You see, generally in the history of the world, revolutions and rebellions do not arise from the poorest and lowliest of the people. Revolutions and rebellions are usually led by those who are in the upper class. They're usually led by those who have the time and the means to press contending claims. The poor and those who are in lower estate don't have the time, they don't have the money, they can't maintain the effort. They are striving simply to get by, to feed and clothe themselves, to keep body and soul together. It takes time and money to have rebellion. And the easiest way to keep men from falling into rebellion is not allow them to have excessive amounts of free time and keep them from having too much money. Mamukin's concern then may be very well founded, because the nobility would have some of that time and money. Mamukin may very well have been located in the very nobility, the nobility that would have been the first to follow the queen's evil example. He may be seeing it already firsthand. And yet, as I've said before, there's a trickling down of practice and ethics in societies. What the upper class does matters to the rest of the nation. It does matter, then, what kind of upper class resides in a nation. It does matter whether or not we have an upper class composed of debauched characters like actors and rock stars. Or if our upper class is composed of those who are of a more genteel and cultivated nature. It does matter to a society. And Mamukin knows this firsthand. Verse 21. And the saying pleased the king and the princes. And the king did according to the word of Mamukin. The saying pleased the king. What Mamukin advocated, we are told, was pleasing to the king. Which is to say, the king was, literally the Hebrew says it was good in the eyes of the king. It means that he saw it as something good, and so he is ready to accept the various propositions together with the suggested remedies that have been spelled out here. Now notably, I think, with the acceptance of Mamukin's counsel, the king is rejecting Vashti as queen. And with this, Vashti vanishes from the Book of Esther, and her memory is no more. Another reason why I think the suggestion that she ultimately perishes is not without merit. Now remember, Vashti's name refers to her beauty. But beauty is fleeting. And in a kingdom which is being governed by vanity, its value is only momentary. She's only beautiful for a short period of time. She would have been better served then to have managed her beauty and charm without bringing offense to the king or to his counselors. But evidently, Vashti was not privy to good counsel. The saying pleased the king and the princes. Perhaps this is why no other counsel even appears in the narrative. It seems that what Mamukin has done here is he's persuaded not only the king, but all of the other princes, all the other counselors that surround the king. Now, again, I would say this suggests at least that those who are seated with him were already quite possibly feeling some kind of domestic disturbance, which they attributed to the queen and her example. Now, it's not to say that they didn't have problems before this. But once Mamukin suggests that these problems are because of the queen, it becomes very easy for them to buy into this, because men are always grasping, looking for easy scapegoats, explanations and scapegoats for the problems they face. The saying pleased the king and the princes, and the king did according to the word of Mamukin. The advice being accepted, what we find out here is that Ahasuerus is, as king, is a man of action. We're told he did according to the counsel of Mamukin. Now, I suspect that it may well, because of the nature of the case, it may well have felt better to him. He might have felt more confident leaving a decision respecting the Queen in the hand or hands of others. Whatever thoughts, then, that he might have had on his own, whether he had initially hoped to find mitigating circumstances that might merit some kind of mercy. What is clear now is this: the cause of the Queen is lost after Mamukin speaks. Verse 22. For he sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof, into every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people. For he sent letters into all the king's provinces. That is, the king. The king sent his dispatches into all the provinces over which he ruled. Now, what these were official letters. Letters of proclamation, which were most likely sent with the intent that they would be read aloud in the public squares of every population center. And the way this happened was they had royal heralds, those who were appointed to read these declarations, and all the people were summoned to this reading in this or that location. So that's likely what we're talking about here. These aren't just simply letters like you write to a friend or a family member when you're away. These are official proclamations, royal edicts. And they're presented in such a way that nobody's going to be allowed to mistake the origin or intent of these edicts. Now the Jews note that these letters made the king appear foolish before the people. And again, I think that this is a comment that has some merit. And I'll explain why over the course of the book. But the basic reason is this. The combination of the harsh punishment that is going to be detailed in this edict, in response to perceived disloyalty to the king by his wife, at the very least, it's going to make him appear to be a very rash fellow in the eyes of the subjects. And if it becomes apparent, all the circumstances, the drinking party and the confusion that ensues in the council, and the fact the wise men apparently don't really want to participate in this finding, and the fact that the youngest member of the council, that he, in fact, is the one who steps forward to offer this solution. The fact that of all of these things, that when you put all these facts together, it does, I think, make the king appear to be a bit foolish. He's rash, he's foolish, he's impulsive. It's not really what you want in a leader. And so the Jews say that later, when he sends out his letters against the congregation of Israel, when he's seeking to kill all the Jews, they say that one reason the people hesitate, and we'll see that later, as I say, we'll see that they wait till the last possible day of the decree. The reason for the hesitation, according to the rabbis, is the people have already perceived that the king made one rash, harsh, impulsive decision that, again, as we'll see, probably doesn't turn out so well in his thinking and in his memory going forward. And that makes them according to the rabbis, a little bit more hesitant to jump on this matter of just killing all of the Jews. The people are hesitant then to act out of fear that this might turn out to be a rash decision and it might be one that he will regret, and maybe he'll come to regret before they're involved in carrying it out. So they don't want to be putting themselves in harm's way by going too quickly about it. Anyhow, he sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof. So each province, all 127, receive a copy of the decree. So the deed of the queen is going to be memorialized as ignominious throughout the Persian Empire. As far as it goes, as the drinking feast disbands, the satraps, the other rulers, all those who were in Shushan, the palace, and in that garden with the king, they're going to return to their respective homes, taking with them word of the queen's rebellion and of the king's decisive, though perhaps very harsh, action against it. Now, this edict, as it appears in the following clause, had particular respect to the concern for maintaining domestic affairs in the house of every man. He sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof, to every people after their language. And that clause tells us something I find very interesting. That is that the Persian government, unlike, for example, the Romans, apparently doesn't use an official language when speaking to the people. And the Romans had an official correspondence. You wanted to write to Rome, you wrote in Latin. When Rome spoke to the provinces, the decree went forth in Latin. Someone had to take time to translate it if it needed to be translated. But here the Persians are showing that they really are, in some respects, benevolent tyrants over some, at least some of the conquered people. They administer the government in the language of the people under their control. They're not pushing for total amalgamation. They're content that these people remain distinct. They're not trying to breed them out of existence or in some way to commit some sort of genocide against them. They're not trying to cause them to cease to be who they are. He sent letters into all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writing thereof, to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house. Now in that, the decree of the Persian king is really the same as that of the Apostle Paul. It's right, just, and according to natural order for men to have rule over their own households. In fact, anything that undermines that is wickedness and rebellion. And rebellion, we're told in Scripture, is a sin of witchcraft. Of course, it really should need no royal decree for women to treat their husbands in this manner and subject themselves to their rule normally. Now, the clause actually seems to indicate that the effect of the publication of this decree would be this. It would be to cause men to be the rulers of their homes when they heard of the sad end of the queen. So you should think of that as more as because. It's causal. So when the decree is issued, the result is going to be, the effect is going to be reestablishing that order. Women would be put off from any impulsive rebellion when they hear news of how the king restored domestic order in his own house. That every man should bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people. Again, the meaning of this appears to follow that every man bear the rule of his own household, and that's why this decree is to be published in the language of his people. It's to make it intelligible wherever it goes. I want to make a few observations before we conclude. First, there's a danger, I think, when matters of great moment are made subject to the pleasures of men. And this is especially true in cases like the one before us, when men's passions are aroused. Think of it. Anger, vanity, and every kind of moral confusion which has been aroused under the influence of drinking. All of these things together yield a fatal cocktail for the queen, and they're going to leave a very bitter taste in the mouth of the king. It's true, as the events unfold, the king appears to be pleased, at least for a time. But as I said earlier, his later actions, I think, are best explained by a secret bitterness or regret or some sort of hesitation that he now will have about the outcome, and a certain amount of disappointment that he now perceives in the counsel he received at that time. In other words, it might have seemed good and even expedient at that time to take this harsh action against the queen. But I think that there are plenty of reasons throughout the book of Esther to think that he came to have regrets. I think that a king with a mind and heart full of regret actually explains better a lot of his actions later. Amazingly, in all of this, at no time does it ever appear that the king seems to consider that had he not forced the queen to appear before him, had he not done that, he wouldn't have put her in a position to make this refusal. In fact, had he forced her to appear before him, what he would have done is he would have stripped her of some of her natural modesty. He would have left her in a very degraded and dispirited state. Nor is there any indication in all of this that at any time does he perceive that it was his own vanity that provokes the vanity of his wife to bring about that offense. So in all of this, I think it's best for us to see that when judgments are rendered apart from passions, real justice is better served. Next, I think we also see the importance that those who are asked to give counsel are not themselves involved in the matter under consideration. Better that those who have some stake in the outcome recuse themselves. They're not really in a good place to render justice and judgment in equilibrium. Now, in matters of state, it is therefore a special concern that counselors are removed from all of their private interests before they are allowed to influence policy. They shouldn't be allowed this. It's a conflict of interest. It may have been that Memucan would have offered very different advice had he not had something against the queen, had he not had some kind of animus or anxiety brewing with respect to her. Consider as well how very different the outcome would have been if God's law had prevailed. First of all, if God's law had been followed in this society, there would have been no drunken party. There would have been no gathering in which men were giving themselves over to that kind of debauched behavior. Second, if God's law had prevailed in the Persian society, the king would have ruled in fear of God rather than being lifted up with pride and swollen with vanity. He would have walked walked in humility. A third, if God's law had been followed in this society, the queen would have been guided by the principles of true religion, and she would have exercised humility. And should her husband expect something sinful from her? Rather than making a bold refusal, she would have given a soft answer and turned away his wrath. Fourth, if God's law had reigned and ruled and prevailed in the Persian society, it's most likely that the younger would have respected the elders, and there might have been much more discussion about the matter without turning it into a civil crisis. Fifth, if God's laws had prevailed, the fact is the counselors would have been well taught and catechized in the principles of true faith, and in such a multitude of counselors, there would be genuine safety. Sixth, had God's laws prevailed, there would have been justice tempered with mercy, so that the punishment or the chastisement would not have exceeded the infraction. And seventh, had the principles of the gospel prevailed, it might all have ended with the king exercising his right to overlook the matter. For, as we're told in Scripture, it's the glory of kings to do such. Think then of the great mercy in the law of Christ, which allows for the dissolution of marriage only for fornication. Because of this, we're taught the need to exercise care. Husbands must love their wives. Wives must obey their husbands until death do them part. Christian marriage encourages men to find true and lasting peace because it's not very easily sundered. Christian marriage encourages women to obey their husbands so that they don't have to exist continually in a state of war. And in a Christian land, that kind of marriage would be enforced. When there were marital problems in Geneva, and men sought divorce, one of the first things that they did in Geneva is they would put the man and the wife in a room, in a cell, with one plate and one spoon and one glass. They would have to learn to get along. In a Persian society, where monarchs reign with absolute power, the wife of the queen is never, or the wife, the queen, is never really safe. She's always subject to the possibility of being removed and even put to death. Now, this leads, I think, to thoughts about the nature of binding laws. You see, Ahasuerus, like all of the rulers of Medo-Persia, Ahasuerus had power to turn a decree into an unalterable law by entering it into the written statutes. It's by putting it in the statute book. However, I want you to note that what he does actually undermines the binding law of God, which does not prescribe divorce or putting of death of the spouse for the refusal to comply with the command of the king or the husband, even in a matter which itself might be a grievous offense against the man. But you see, it's characteristic of the heathen to elevate their own desires above the express law of God. But consider this. In entering into that marriage, the king took a vow before God and man. And Solomon says in Ecclesiastes 5, "When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that thou hast vowed. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay." In breaking that vow, he displayed the greatest folly. It was a breach. A breach through which he brought sorrow to himself and his kingdom. Nevertheless, the sin of the king is turned by God to his own glory and the deliverance of Israel. And just like the crucifixion, God turns the wrath of man to his praise and the good of his people. Consider again that if the Persians were so careful to make certain their edicts were given to the people in their own language, how much more does this justify the efforts of the Protestant churches to have the scriptures translated into the common languages of the peoples throughout the earth? After all, mustn't we affirm the message of the scriptures is of much higher and more abiding authority than any edict of a Persian monarch? How damnable, then, the decrees of the Romish Antichrist that would seek to prevent men from having the Bible in their own language. How foolish that we ever had to have that contest. Finally, we should understand the law is made for the wicked and the unbeliever. Christians should never need a royal decree or government edict which enforces men to rule in their households or enforces women to give honor to their husbands. This should be both expected and commended as the order, the very order which cherishes nature and nourishes grace in the family. See, the wisdom of the heathen at his best reflects the contours of the natural moral law. On the other hand, at its worst, it displays the worst kind of tyranny over the minds and spirits of men. And that's why it's folly. When it's right, it's redundant. And when it's wrong, it's oppressive. What has Mamukin actually accomplished by all of this? I think he succeeded in doing several things. First, he's convinced Ahasuerus to depose and probably kill Vashti. And that's a move that, as I suggest, will be seared in the heart of Ahasuerus to depose later Haman. Because the mind of the king and the effect that it's going to have on his actions towards Haman at a later time is going to be directly influenced, I think, by this earlier decision. Didn't work out so well getting counsel. Next time, I think I'll leave that step out. Of course, Mamukin has done another thing, a second thing. He's convinced the king to clear the way for Esther to ascend to the royal throne. He doesn't know this, but that's exactly what he's done. Remember, Mamukin's name means preparation, according to the rabbis. It's from a root word which means preparation. Third, he's convinced Ahasuerus to act as an absolute tyrant, a dictator, without restraint, without counsel, without law, to act above the law and even beside the law according to his own pleasure. And this again becomes a snare for Haman, the enemy of God's people, when the king will respond to him without constraint, without law, and he will have him killed. And fourth, I take the position of the rabbis as being another position of merit, that Mamukin has advised Ahasuerus to send out letters throughout the whole kingdom informing the people of these rash decisions, and that in some sense this is going to have an effect of making them hesitate when he sends out his next royal edict calling for the killing of the Jews. Herein then lies the problem with the Jews who incorporated themselves with this society. Not only are they drunken at this civil festival, but now they're made to drink down the dregs of their heathenism with this decree. They were tempted to exercise power without possessing that authority which comes from God alone, moral authority. But in the kingdom of vanity, everything that happens, all of it is set to be turned to misery. The Jews that have forsaken their first love are going to find that redemption does not come then by the strength of the flesh. You're going to find that it comes by God working by His Spirit. And just as the Spirit blows whithersoever He will, and men don't know, in the book of Esther, the Spirit of God is continually working, and yet we never hear mention of God at all. Amen.